38 members of the think tank community from all across the ideological spectrum are signatories to an open letter on Defense Department reform. Phil Carter is director of the Military Veterans and Society Program at Center for New American Security and my guest on Pentagon Solutions today. Phil's one of the signers of this letter. Phil, thank you very much for being on the program. As always, it's good to talk to you again. What made you and your colleagues in the think tank community think that this would be an effective way to address the issues that you wanted to address, this open letter to both administration officials and congressional officials? Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me, Francis. And I should first start with a note of humility. Of course, we're a bunch of think tankers. We should be relatively humble about our potential to have impact. We do research, we do writing. And so we thought that beyond another policy tome of which many of us have written, many of them, that an open letter like this in a magazine like Politico would be the most direct way to provide essentially a brief on this subject to members of Congress and their staffs and members of the administration, what we really see is a bipartisan defense consensus around certain areas of defense reform.
Some of the issues that you address in here are issues that have been bouncing around in Washington and in the thought community around the Defense Department for a long time. But I note that you start this out by saying the administration, with some support from key members of Congress, has made some incremental and modest changes that begin to bend the cost curves in personnel, comp, and infrastructure. What do you see personally, or what do you you and your colleagues collectively see that the Pentagon, the Defense Department, the administration as a whole is doing right regarding DOD?
What the Pentagon seems to be doing very right here is making an objective case about the trade-offs between readiness and modernization, between reform and the ability to sustain the force. And they're basing it on pretty solid data about the extent to which the current infrastructure, the current civilian workforce, and the current model for military compensation is unsustainable. Unfortunately, what they're running into is a much different political environment than has existed 10, 20, or 30 years ago. You know, when we downsized the military after the Cold War, there was a much different body politic in existence then today, and a very different set of leaders on Capitol Hill that were able to form a bipartisan defense consensus about things like BRAC, the Base Realignment and Closure Commission. Now that consensus is gone. And so even when you have leaders of both parties, professionals of both parties, backed up by reams of data, there seems to be no constituency that can come together on the Hill in support of something like BRAC, let alone even more contentious things like personnel compensation reform.
Do you take any comfort at all in the fact that there is at least some money to study a future round of BRAC in the NDAA, at least so far? It hasn't been marked out of the bill yet.
Absolutely. There's reason to believe that the seeds of reform are planted and that with the right nourishment and the right conditions, they could grow into much more significant reforms in a year or 2 years. I mean, every 2 years, we see an opportunity for change with a new round of elections and potentially new leadership, both in Congress and in the White House in 2 years. That could make a difference. It's possible that study of BRAC and the potential savings of the department and the savings of the taxpayer could make a difference. But the risk here is that even solid analysis and solid data regarding the potential savings or the right answer, so to speak, is not going to go anywhere without real political will and political change on the Hill.
The last time that Secretary Catherine Hammock from the Army was here, the Undersecretary for Installations, Energy, and Environment, she talked pretty extensively and pretty eloquently, I think, about BRAC and made the Army's case and the Defense Department's case for base realignment and closure. The infrastructure success that they've had reducing in Europe was a model that she used as we could do that here. She addressed something that you and your colleagues address in this letter, and that is that the 2005 round of BRAC that the Congress is citing as, well, it didn't really work out the way that we expected, actually was not really the BRAC that's intended. Do you see it that way as well, Phil?
A little bit, and I think it's also useful to look at some of the arguments that are being lodged back now as potential reasons why we shouldn't do BRAC. The Chairman McCain and others have suggested that we've gone too far, for example, in pulling the military apart from civil society, and that there might be a civil-military cost to pay with BRAC. Well, that's sort of a non-answer. I mean, what we have on the table is pretty good evidence that closing XX bases saves money that can then be reinvested into the current force and the future force. And right now, the Defense Department is running at a very inefficient clip, and it's only going to get worse as the infrastructure on these dispersed and small bases ages and requires more and more resources to maintain going forward.
So I don't mean to pick on the Army, but since I've mentioned them already, we'll use them as an example. One of the arguments that I've heard from the Hill as a reason to oppose another round of BRAC is, yes, we're saying today, given the current financial situation that we're in, we're going to draw down from 490,000 soldiers to 450 or 420 or whatever the final number has to be. But what happens if we find ourselves in 5 years or 10 years in some kind of a conflict where we've got to plus up and we've got to go back to 490, or we've got to go to 550, or God forbid it has to get bigger than that? Where are we going to put all those people, and are we going to have to turn around and reopen or reclaim or rebuild or whatever? What's your sense of that based? I mean, you lived this, you served, and so what is your sense of that from the point of view of a service member?
That's a great question, and it's okay to pick on my former service as the Army. I think it's a fair one.
Because you know I'm not picking too, Phil.
The bases we have today are not necessarily the bases you would want if you had to expand the Army in the future, particularly if you did so under wartime conditions where you really put a premium on deployable force structure and training space and that sort of thing. You'd probably want to build out your big mega bases with expansibility, places like Fort Bliss in the West Texas desert, Fort Bragg in North Carolina, the Joint Base Lewis-McChord with its fantastic access to the Pacific Rim and its large training areas. These are the bases where you're going to have the potential for expansibility and for growth in a future Army should you need it. You've also got a tremendous capability for expansibility in the reserve components, and that shouldn't be forgotten here. You probably wouldn't keep the same small bases that are vulnerable to BRAC. Those are not the platforms and the lily pads that you would build a future Army on top of.
So it sounds like then that maybe the strategy that we could see more of, and I'm not suggesting the Defense Department hasn't done this, I just haven't heard a lot about it yet. I haven't heard a lot about elasticity in the way they would like to go about conducting a round of BRAC, and I haven't heard nearly as much emphasis on the realignment in BRAC, as I have on the C.
I think that's right. You also haven't heard a lot about force mixture options and expansibility, and I think that may be a big focus for the future of the Army Commission that's just getting off the ground with its 8 members selected and is now staffing up. It's certainly going to be a focus for that service because they've got the majority of the manpower across all 3 components and potentially the most to gain by coming to a better mixture.
So I don't mean to focus entirely on BRAC because you and your colleagues and peers wrote about a number of other issues. One of them is the civilian workforce at the Department of Defense. And I can't think of anybody, not just you and your 37 colleagues, but I can't think of anybody anywhere in Washington that thinks that the size of the workforce as it is now, with about 750,000 civilian employees and about the same number of contractors, is really ideal. That seems to be the one thing of all of the things that you address, that there really is a fair amount of consensus that it's time to do is to shrink that number.
There is. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of consensus about how best to do it. I think that it's too easy to beat up on the federal workforce and say we ought to just cut positions and we ought to do so across the board. The challenge is, as we've seen with things like sequestration-driven cuts, you can't do that that smartly. We probably need to take a more precise approach, looking at requirements that can be changed, reporting requirements, staffing requirements, headquarters requirements, et cetera, and really gradually delayering the system, clearing out offices, headquarters, layers of bureaucracy that are simply unnecessary, but doing so very smartly. The other thing we lack is we lack a great deal of information about how many people we actually have, and that's particularly true on the contractor side of the ledger, where because of the mechanisms we use to procure services, sometimes fixed-price contracts, sometimes cost-type contracts, we don't always know how many people are working on that other side. And better data about that would enable better analysis of how many people we have working, what tasks they're doing, whether those tasks are necessary, and assuming they are, what's the most efficient way to do them.
No, go ahead. Please finish, Phil. Sorry.
We need better data in order to figure out the best ways to make those cuts.
Well, and I wonder if the way you consider that data might be helpful, too. If we think about it as we have X number of employees, is that the way to do it? Or is the way to do it to consider capabilities or FTEs? Or, I mean, I guess the way we've always done it, in this case, counting heads, is not necessarily the way we should always do it.
I think that's right. And there's also enormous potential with new business models that are coming into being and new ways of operating that the private sector has gotten good at, but they still haven't made their way into government. So if you look at a modern day company that does health insurance or that does benefits administration or anything of an administrative nature, they leverage the power of big data. They leverage the power of automation. They do things with fewer people than the Defense Finance and Accounting Service, or DFAS, or the Defense Travel System, or others do in government. And so there's a whole wave of innovation and revolution in terms of business practices that needs to sweep over the Defense Department and really change the way that it does business. And I think in doing so, you'll probably come to a lot of savings by doing business in more efficient ways.
Are you encouraged by some of the developments at the Defense Department to try to do things more like the private sector? For example, the Defense Health Agency, where they've taken some of the authorities that each individual branch used to control and put them under DHA?
DHA's got an enormous challenge. And the single thing I'm most optimistic about is that they can start through their new TRICARE contract that's going to be competed soon and through their big electronic health records procurement, that they can start procuring outcomes instead of processes. If they can start orienting on the outcomes they want for service members and for the agency, then I think they can get to a place where they're able to find efficiencies and also find better outcomes.
Phil Carter of the Center for a New American Security is one of the signatories of an open letter on defense reform to both the Secretary of Defense and other administration officials and a number of congressional leaders in Congress. And when we come back, more on the topics that he and his colleagues are writing about, you can find a link to this letter at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. And my conversation with Phil Carter continues in a moment on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, continuing my conversation on Pentagon Solutions today with Phil Carter of the Center for a New American Security. He and 37 of his colleagues in the think tank community signed an open letter to Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter and to leaders of important key defense committees in Congress. We were talking before the break, Phil, about the situation with civilian employees and contractors at the Department of Defense. And you talked about the data, and you mentioned in this letter, you and your colleagues, that the Government Accountability Office has been on the trail of the Defense Department to collect the information that would make this more feasible for a long time, and they haven't done it yet. Now, I've talked to the GAO on a number of occasions, and I don't want to put words in their mouths, but the sense that I take away from those conversations is that so far it just hasn't been a priority for DOD. It's not that they're avoiding it or anything malicious about it. So it seems to me that makes it easier because that means somebody just has to decide it has to be a priority. Is that a fair read on my part, do you think, Phil?
It's a fair read. I think it's also a consequence of the fiscal environment for the last 14 years where the Defense Department hasn't really been forced to do these sorts of things because the budgets have kept going up. There's always been this contingency operation slush fund to tap into, and there have been other ways to make ends meet. As we enter, or rather continue further into this age of fiscal austerity, the Defense Department may need to find the will to do so. And it certainly has the power to do so and the ability to do so, given that it manages all these civilian employees internally and generally has contractual oversight over all of its contractors and can certainly require employee data from them if they asked.
The other element that you and your colleagues write about in this letter is, you write, it's time for a comprehensive modernization of the military compensation system. I've talked on this program a number of times about the Comp Commission's report, the recommendations that they made, and I've been struck by the reception that they've gotten. I mean, you are well aware of how many times a Blue Ribbon Commission writes recommendations, they go in a binder, they go on shelves, and you never hear from them again. Congressman Thornberry's included a number of them in this year's NDAA markup. The administration's already said we support 10 of them and we're going to look at the others. Are you optimistic? Does that progress make you optimistic, I guess, that this won't be another blue ribbon panel that whose work sits on a shelf, Phil?
I think it is, and I'm particularly optimistic about the changes to the military retirement system. The current proposal to add thrift savings plan coverage with matching contributions is a good one. It doesn't just help with retirement reform, but it also helps with personnel reform writ large. The current retirement system really calcifies a lot of the system and makes it really hard to do things like career intermission and flexibility and on-ramps and off-ramps between the public and private sector. And so this new model has a lot of virtue for other personnel reform ideas as well. There still is a challenge with the sustainability of the current model and some of the rates of base pay and special pay growth over the last 25 years, that we need to see sustained rationality in this space in order to produce long-term cost savings. And it remains to be seen whether we can do this over the next 5 to 10 years. And also bear in mind that, you know, if we start to commit large numbers of combat forces again, if we start find ourselves in another large-scale conflict, I think all bets are off, that it really isn't possible to change compensation and benefits at a time that we have people engaged in major combat operations. Politically, that's a non-starter.
You talked about timing in this letter, and I want to come back to that when we wrap up, but there's a bug in my bonnet when it comes to the TSP idea in particular. I'm a huge fan of the thrift savings plan, and I'm envious of it that I will have to become a federal employee someday to be able to participate in it. What I have found striking is that, to my knowledge, and it's entirely possible I've missed it, Phil, but I have not yet heard anybody from the Department of Defense say that the thrift savings plan itself will be the vehicle. I've heard the term 401k-like plan. And my fear is that it will turn into something that DOD decides it's going to set up on its own when the TSP is already sitting right there as an up-and-running model ready to take care of this business.
Well, I sure hope so, and I hope that the powers that be recognize the value in having this existing model that has the capacity to absorb new members, and already does. There are many, many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of military members that are currently TSP users, and it would be a real shame if the government turned its back on that system only to create a new one or to potentially outsource this to the private sector, especially given the fee structure and the value that the TSP provides to its beneficiaries and its users.
Yeah, every single financial planner or investment expert that I talk to, first of all, is already aware of the thrift savings plan. I don't have to educate him about it. And they say exactly what you just said. The TSP is the best deal that exists for anybody because of a number of different factors that we don't have time to get into. I mentioned the timing issue. You and your colleagues write in this letter, now's the time to begin the hard but necessary work to close excess bases, right-size civilian workforce, give future service members more value in a modern pay and benefits package, all of the things that we talked about. Given the election season, this letter says, these questions will surely be deferred until 2017 or later if another year is lost. Some of these things are just not one-year workables, Phil. Some of them are multi-year efforts. Even if work started tomorrow, which we know is not going to happen, is the rest of this congressional year, the first half of the 114th Congress, enough time to make enough progress that it that work then can't be stymied by a year that's probably not going to be very productive next year?
I think so. I'm optimistic about that. I also think that the current leadership in Congress has an opportunity to set the course now with the budgets they put in place and some of the policies they put in place to really put this on a path towards a virtuous place, regardless of who's elected in November 2016. Obviously, there's potential for change, but if the service chiefs and the secretary and this bipartisan group of defense thinkers is behind it and Congress acts, and I think there's at least a chance that these changes, which you rightfully note will take more than a year to consummate, there's a chance these changes will be carried forward long enough to really make a difference.
Do you have a sense of any way to measure whether the opinions that you're putting forth in this letter, which I note are the opinions of each of the individual signers and not of the organizations that you're affiliated with, have made a difference? Is there some way for you to tell, either anecdotally or officially, that somebody said, wow, this group of people from all across the ideological spectrum, from all different places on the overall views of what the Defense Department should look like and how it should work, do agree on these things, and therefore we should do something about it. And then in hindsight, therefore we've done these things about it. Is that knowable, Phil?
You know, it's every think tanker's dream to look at something they write and say, that's had an impact. In this case, we've had some anecdotal conversations with former colleagues and colleagues on the Hill and elsewhere that have signaled this has certainly been read. It's been noticed. It's been noticed that this is a bipartisan effort. We joke that it's everyone from Adams to Zakheim, from A to Z, from left to right. This is not a one-off thing. This is something that a broad majority of the folks that have worked these issues for 40 years believe in. And I think that has had an impact, much more so than any one of our one reports or any one of our one op-eds has.
I count both Adams and both Zakheims, who've signed this letter, as friends of mine and friends of the show. And so I can say you're exactly right. That really is the spectrum, Phil.